The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite. Nothing in this podcast is intended as investment advice, and the people in this podcast may hold positions in the stocks they talk about. Do not buy anything based solely on a tip or recommendation. Please do your own research.
Welcome to the podcast on Thursday, the 6th of September, 2018. On the podcast today, I have Peter Bird, Chief Executive Officer of Asia Met Resources, ARS, his ticker there. And Peter discusses the progress they're making on their copper projects in Indonesia. And of course, their BKM project is coming towards now a bankable feasibility study very soon. Also on the podcast, Stephen Williams, Co-Chief Executive Officer of Rehoboth Resources, RBD, is a ticker there. And Stephen talks about their fundraise and the success they recently experienced at their Californian operation. Plus, as of Thursday, Chris Bailey, founder of FinancialOrbit.com, covering Centrica, Dixon Carphone Warehouse, and McCarthy Stone. And as always, I have the top five most followed companies on Vox Markets in the last 24 hours, and the top five most liked RNSs too.
Fleet Mortgages are a specialist buy-to-let lender dealing exclusively with intermediaries. In our first 3 years, we've had over 1,400 broker firms place business with us, helped more than 3,500 landlords develop their buy-to-let portfolios, and lent over £1 billion. We offer simple rental calculations, like our 125% at 5% available for all taxpayers. Call us today on 01252 916 800.
And joining me on the podcast right now is Peter Bird, CEO of Asia Met Resources, ARS's ticker. Peter, thanks for joining me.
Yeah, thanks, Justin. Great to speak to you again.
Yeah, well, you've got a lot going on there, and so it's always nice to catch up, because I know there's a lot of things going on in the background. I know you're very busy, and even though you can't RNS everything that's happening, we know you are very busy. So you've got a lot of shareholders asking for updates, so it's nice for you to come on. But for people who are sort of maybe looking out for copper projects and stuff like that, but are not familiar with your story, can you explain or summarise in a minute or less, what is Asia Met all about, Peter?
Yeah, sure. So Asia Met, as you said, Justin, is a copper-focused company. It has an extensive portfolio of assets focused in Indonesia, which comprise currently we currently have 2.4 million tonnes of copper metal in resource in our portfolio, which is very significant. And we're probably valued today as we sit at about 3.5 to 4 cents per pound in the ground. So what does that really mean? What that means is that we are on the escalator of value. We're at the low end. And I think with what we're doing with our initiatives on our projects, that'll just continue to ride up that escalator. We've got one project in Central Kalimantan, which is in feasibility, which is the BKM project. And then we have a second large project in Western Sumatra called Butong, which we have an 80% equity interest in, which we've been drilling recently and had some very exciting results on.
Excellent stuff. Okay, it's worth going into the copper price, because of late it's come off a bit on trade talks about trade tariffs with Trump and China and all this stuff. But, you know, largely the story's unaffected. And I see even today, I think, or yesterday, Bloomberg came out with saying everyone loves copper, and we've had a lot of stories of targets being taken over. But what's your thoughts on the copper price? And I mean, because, you know, your share price now is becoming quite correlated to it. Not as much as producers would be, but what's your thoughts on the price of copper there, Peter?
Yeah, it's a great question. I mean, copper is it's a staple of everyday life, like milk and bread, really, and people just don't realise that. And just for listeners who are not aware, the copper market as a consumption market is around 22 to 23 million tonnes of copper per annum is consumed. And consumption has been pretty consistent over a long period of time, but it's been growing at around 2% per annum consumption since the 1950s. So if you do the maths really quickly, what does that mean? It means that every year the supply side, which we're involved in, has to find somewhere between 400,000 to 500,000 tonnes of new production per annum to sort of satisfy the beast, you know, to satisfy the demand. And the demand's very simple stuff. It's pipes, it's wire, And now we've got the advent of sort of electric vehicles and all those sorts of things, which is very exciting. So, and solar. So it's just a staple of everyday life. And back to your question on copper price, we've seen a dip recently in the past couple of months or perhaps 3 months on all the talk of trade wars. But the reality is that the demand will continue. So I really see the dip as a very much a short-term thing. And just to give listeners a bit of a sense, if we look at China as a consumer, it consumes, of that 22 million tonnes, it consumes almost 50% of that production, of that 22 million tonnes. And of that 50%, they have to import around 65 to 75% product to satisfy their demand. And the Chinese economy, in its inverted commas depressed state, is still growing at 6% per annum. So you do the maths really quickly and you can see that it's a very, very robust market. The big issue that the world faces with copper is that in the past 10 years, there's been very little money spent on finding new projects. So we've got a supply side problem. Mm-hmm. And so I think the risk on copper price is on the upside, not the downside, because substitution is a real issue. There's very little you can substitute, particularly for wire and pipe, in the day-to-day world. And if we look at electric vehicles, all the wiring and all that sort of thing, or solar, is copper. So it's a pretty exciting space to be in, Justin.
Yeah. Well, I was looking at some news today about the biggest wind farm in the UK is just opening, and that involves a lot of copper. And you've got these big emerging markets, of course, that are developing that need copper. And then you add on top of that, like you say, the EV, clean energy revolution. So let's go into, at the moment, I know it's not your priority target at the moment, but you are doing drilling holes there. But everyone's quite excited about Bouchon, which is the biggie in your portfolio there. Now, you've drilled some quite deep, exciting holes. You've come back with some decent grades, I suppose. Explain, take us through what you found there and what your thoughts are on those holes, please.
Yeah, sure, Justin. So, again, for listeners, we've got two projects, one in central Kalimantan, which is more advanced, which is the BKM project, and then the Bouchon asset, which sits behind that. So just to give people a sense, Bouchon is approximately six times bigger than the first project, the KSK Bouchon, KSK project. And our objective there is we raised some money earlier in the calendar year to investigate just how big Bouchon might be. So it's currently got in resource 2.4 million tonnes of contained copper. So it's a big system. It's a world-class system. It outcrops at surface, and we've drilled Bouchon currently to about 500 to 600 vertical metres. So, again, for listeners, in these big porphyry systems, that's shallow. These systems can be somewhere between 1 and 2 kilometres in vertical extent, and we're only down 500 metres. So we've got a lot of work to do. But what the drilling has validated is a number of things. In addition to the current 2.4 million tonne resource, some of this drilling, which we've announced recently, which has had some very positive results, is outside of the existing resource. So we're quite optimistic that as we progress and evaluate this project, we'll grow the resource. But really for us internally, what we're doing is validating what we thought we already knew, which that is that we're on a big porphyry system. It's likely to grow. It's quite exciting. And it is really world class. So, there's other sort of similar projects like Wafi Golpu in Papua New Guinea, Cascabel in Ecuador, and these sorts of projects. So we're on a similar beast. And the drilling results we've had are exceptional. I mean, they're really very exciting, and it really motivates us to sort of further evaluate and see whether or not we can grow this. But I'm really optimistic. I think we've only scratched the top off this. it's early. We're in the top 500 metres and there's a lot more work to do.
Yeah, when you say, for people not aware, it's a pore-free system, what does that mean, Peter?
Yeah, so just to try and paint a picture of a pore-free system for the uninitiated, a pore-free system in copper looks a little bit like sort of holding your fist up in the air and surrounding the top of your fist is a halo of mineralization. So what we've discovered is the top of that halo, so that, you know, your knuckles and your thumb. What we haven't done is evaluated whether or not that halo drapes down over, you know, the bottom of your hand and down to your wrist. So if that's a good description. So we've evaluated the top 500 vertical meters. It's very positive. We've got some exceptional intersections, which we've announced. So we're on a very big porphyry system. They're generally reasonably consistent grades. But the thing that makes this one stand out a little bit is, well, there's two things. The first thing is, if you like, geomorphology or geography, is that unlike a lot of porphyries around the world, it outcrops at surface. So we don't have to drill for 300 or 400 vertical metres to discover the top of the ore body. It outcrops. So that's a great, from a commercial point of view, that's very exciting. I think the second thing that you just cannot underestimate is that the regional logistics are exceptional. So we're 60 kilometres by a bitumen or a paved road from the coast. At the coast, there's a deep sea port and a 220 megawatt power station, which is, the power station's about 50% utilised. So we don't have to build a power station, we don't have to build a port, and we don't have to build a road. So when you start doing your maths on evaluating these projects, that adds up to a lot of money. So we think that this will be globally very competitive as a project, as opposed to something that's much more isolated from a logistics point of view.
Yeah, well, you mentioned there's some investments taking place, you know, other sort of big copper sort of plays like SolGold. And you mentioned earlier that at the moment it's sort of 4 cents in the ground. Is there any way, do you know how much these other projects are valued at, cents in the ground?
Well, I think the point to make is we're probably trading at about 3.5 to 4 cents per pound of copper in the ground, you know, with our existing resource inventory. Recent transactions that have taken place, like Avanco, et cetera, are up to about 14 cents per pound. So we're certainly, the value argument has not been recognised, and it was fascinating to observe the transaction that occurred, I think it occurred yesterday, with BHP and SolGold, which is a very smart transaction. But it just tells you that big corporate organisations recognise that there's a supply-side problem and they need to position themselves in good quality assets in order to provide, you know, the supply side as we go forward in the next 5 to 10 years. So we're just, as I said at the very start, we're at the bottom of the escalator and probably been hiding our story a bit undercover, but it will be revealed that we've got an exceptional portfolio.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk about BFS on BKM there. So that's nearing completion, as you mentioned in the last update. And you say there's, in the final stages, and the process involves significantly opportunity for the company to optimise and improve the economics of the project through value engineering and benchmarking. How is it going there? I know it's hugely complex in a VFS. So I have no idea what's going on there.
And look, the short answer is it's going well. But, it does. And again, probably for the listeners, just to explain a little bit, it's not a 10-page report that we put together to advance our projects. It's literally some thousands of pages where we engage experts in a whole suite of fields, from metallurgy to chemical, mining engineering, construction engineering, electrical engineering, environmental, et cetera, et cetera. So what we're going through at the minute is a process of value engineering, where we've received initial reports, which ourselves and the team that provide that information work on improving the information. So it's a very sort of common pathway to take for companies to go through this value process. So we're working through that with all of the service providers and internal consultants, etc., to hopefully deliver what we believe is an exceptional outcome. We haven't got the final results yet, but we're getting very close. And as soon as we do get them, we'll deliver the outcomes.
Marvelous stuff. And then, this is the final sort of big milestone before, I suppose, construction, is it? Or
probably not the final milestone before construction. I think once the feasibility study is delivered, then we move into the next phase, which is the financing and permitting piece, which, again, quite systematic. It's very normal. People shouldn't be alarmed about that. It's what everyone does at the next stage. And then in parallel with that, once we put the financing piece together, we'll start engaging with construction people to move into the construction element with the objective of delivering production in 2020. So, look, it's all running to schedule. We're very pleased with how things are going with the team. But there's a lot of moving parts, and people will probably be amazed at how many people are involved in putting it together. But it's some tens or twenties of people putting together all of these packages to move forward into production. And remember that with this particular project, we see this as what we call the enabler project. Just to remind people, it's a sort of 25,000 tonne per annum copper cathode production in central Kalimantan, but within the existing contract of work, we've got an additional, I think it's 33 other projects we have to evaluate subsequent to this one to see whether or not we can bring them into evaluation and potentially subsequent production. So we see this as first cab off the rank in an exceptional area that has incredible mineral endowment. So we've got this one plus, as we talked about earlier, Bootong. So it's an incredible portfolio to work with.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay. And I see that, you've got some broker targets on you at 19, 20 pence. And so look at the moment suggesting that, like I said, you have taken a little bit of a hit because of the copper price, but this makes the upside sort of compelling longer term, doesn't it? If it's sinking.
Yeah, look, I think it does, and it's a bit of an awkward thing for an executive of a company to talk about its price target, but perhaps just to sort of reiterate what I said a little bit earlier, we're trading at about 3 to 4 cents a pound of copper in the ground. Recent transactions have taken place at in excess of 10 cents per pound of copper in the ground. We've got a very, very defined flight path of activities that we have to execute and complete. And if we complete those, it's very clear that we'll get value generation. So I'm not, perhaps to answer your question, I'm not at all uncomfortable about those sort of price targets. I think if we reflect a little bit on the past 2 or 3 months about the copper price, I think, it's not just AsiaMet, but if you look at other copper-dominated companies, there's been a significant sort of downturn in their price. But people shouldn't be alarmed, because longer term, there's a supply-side problem. And we've got the inventory to deliver into the supply side, and I'm very, very positive about the copper market. So, I'm totally comfortable. I think that, one should be at 9 or 10p. I haven't looked at the price today, but at 9 or 10p, people would be very, very comfortable about investing in our story.
Yeah, well, to summarise it, Peter, if someone's listening right now, likes the sound of this, but are not following the story, give them three quick reasons why they should hit that follow button on your page and add you to their watch list, please.
Yeah, okay, Justin. So I suppose the first one is that we've got a team of people who've done this before, particularly led by our chairman, Tony Mannini. I mean, they've built, operated and run very good quality mines from grassroots right through to production before. So for us, we see this as something that we're quite familiar with. I think the second thing is that just, and we've touched on this a bit in the interview, but the copper market is ripe to sort of really blossom. And but you need to get set early, because once it takes off, you can't catch it. And from a timing perspective, which is the third point, we've got an asset that is development ready. And then sitting behind that is an asset that will grow in inventory. And then thirdly, we have a portfolio which will add to the previous two. So we're a very unusual company, I think, that as a small market cap company, we've got the full package. And therefore, people should really give it some thought when they're looking to invest.
Marvellous stuff. Really good to chat to you. Hopefully, we'll be catching up again in the not-too-distant future. Thanks a lot.
Thanks, Justin. Appreciate it.
The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite.
And joining me on the podcast right now is Stephen Williams, Co-Chief Executive Officer of Rhea Bold Resources. That's RBD ticker. Stephen, thanks for joining me.
Thank you very much.
Now, you've had a bit of news out in the last couple of weeks, so we'll cover that off in a bit. Before we do, if someone's listening right now and thinking, Rhea Bold, I'm not quite familiar with the company, give them a quick summary, Stephen. What's Rhea Bold all about, please?
Yeah, I mean, we're an oil and gas company that does things a little bit differently and is bringing a new model to the junior oil and gas space. And what we essentially do is look to provide capital to high quality pre-cash flow oil and gas projects that have been stuck because of the lack of capital that's been affecting the industry generally. So we provide capital that allows these projects to get wells drilled on them and therefore creates a lot of value in a very short space of time.
Yeah, and quickly, how many projects are you involved with at the moment?
Well, Rhea Bold just kicked off its six-well drilling campaign. So that's six wells across California, offshore UK, and onshore Romania. So a diversified portfolio of projects already in the Rhea Bold mix.
Yeah. Well, let's go into that. The update, you did an update there on California, a discovery at VG3 well. Take us through the detail. What happened here?
Yeah, that's correct. The California operations have been going extremely well. We only closed that acquisition at the start of July, and we've already been able to announce a successful four-well workover program, which is currently in production. And then on top of that, we drilled the first well in that six-well campaign that I talked about, which was the VG3 well on the West Brentwood license, and that was a success. So we were able to report the oil pay that we were expecting, and we also got more gas than we were expecting. So overall, it's been a successful well that was actually ahead of expectations.
Okay, well, can you go into detail there? What were you expecting and what happened?
Well, you know, the reason why we like these assets is in part because they're very low cost and very quick to drill and very easy to operate. So we were able to drill this well in less than 2 weeks on budget. We found oil pay in the zone that we expected, which was essentially we were drilling into a field where there was existing production, historical production, and we were drilling up dip of the old wells in a location that's been identified by subsequent seismic that was shot after those wells were produced. And we found the pay zone right as expected, but as I said, we also got a lot more gas than we were expecting.
Yeah, so what's next here then, Stephen?
So that well will be put onto production. So the team over there is working right now on completing that as a producer, and that should be in production very, very quickly. And as I say, operations over in that part of the world are done very quickly and efficiently. And then we'll also be looking to drill another well in California on the Monroe Swell license area, and that should be going ahead within the next few weeks.
Yeah, and have you given any guidance as to what you're hoping to target, you know, production-wise over the, you know, now and over the next few months?
No, we haven't provided production guidance as yet, but you will see the flow rate come out of that well, obviously, when it goes onto production.
Yeah, absolutely. And as far as other milestones coming up in the portfolio, what's happening?
Well, so we expect to drill two more wells in California this year, the first one being Monroe Swell, which I just talked about. Then we've got the two UK wells that we're expecting to drill in September. We'll drill Wick, and then that's about a 40-day process. And then immediately after that, we expect to drill Coulter off the south coast of England. And then at the end of the year, we drill the sixth well, which is in Romania.
It's quite a busy time for you, isn't it?
Well, you know, that is really the Rhea Bold strategy, right? So we raised capital and then we deploy it into a whole host of projects. But the key is that every project we go into has near-term drilling associated with it. So we expect to constantly have a number of wells upcoming within the next sort of few months at any one point in time.
Yeah, yeah. Well, listen, you talk about capital. You recently raised, $4.8 million. And so what's this going to be used for?
So more of the same, essentially. We look to continue to roll out the strategy. We're looking at a number of very exciting projects that, again, have near-term drilling associated with them. So the six well campaign we talked about was really all to take place in the second half of 2018. This new capital will target new projects that are likely to drill in the first half of 2019. So as I say, we just continue to roll it out, and we never get to the end of the drilling campaign. We're always looking to add more projects on that could create more value for shareholders.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay, well, Stephen, if someone's listening to this, likes the sound of it, but is not following the story as yet, give them three reasons why they should add Rehobold Resources RBD ticker to their watch list, please, on Vox Markets.
Yeah, well, I think the first thing is that that successful result at VG3 was really the final step in proving up the Rehobold model. So we'd already shown we had access to high-quality institutional capital. We'd shown that we can deploy that capital into very exciting, high-impact projects. And then finally, the success at VG3 has proven that we can actually deliver successful drilling results. So that's the first thing. Secondly, I mean, we've talked about this drilling campaign. We have five very exciting, high-impact wells coming in the next few months. So investors will get constant news flow associated with those five wells. And then thirdly, as we touched on, the capital we've raised will allow us to do more. So we will be announcing more asset transactions in the next few weeks as well.
Good stuff, Stephen. Good to chat to you. And like you said, lots going on. So hopefully we catch you up in the not too distant future. Thanks very much.
Thank you.
The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite.
And joining me on the podcast right now is Chris Bailey, founder of financialorbit.com. You all right, Chris?
Hello. Good morning, Justin. Good day to you. How are you?
I'm good, thanks. You said before we started, you know, excuse any bang in the background. We're having a new boiler fitted, but some of the stocks we're talking about are quite relevant. Or one of them are quite relevant to that, I suppose, aren't they?
Well, that's right. You know, I thought to myself, right, I'm going to talk about Centrica today. I didn't realise that I'd be having Centrica or BG, as British Gas is obviously as they're well known as, to pop around to actually install a new boiler for me. So we could get the engineer in to talk about Centrica stock if you wish.
Yeah.
But I know more about boilers than he does about Centrica stock, would be my guess. But hey, who knows? Maybe I'm doing him a huge disservice. Perhaps I should engage him in conversation about potential for Centrica's profitability over the next year or two.
Yeah, no, I guess he's more in tune with the work face rather than the corporate level. He said, listen, mate, don't bother with that. I'm just, getting the boiler. In fact, there's more skill probably in fixing a boiler than being the CEO of Centrica, because let's be honest.
Yes.
They don't have to really do a lot.
Well, I don't know.
The thing is, if you get sacked from that level, though, you never really fail. I mean, you go into, if you do a bad job, you give a nice payoff. And then you've got plenty of time where if you've got in a blaze of nonsense, people in the headlines to say, oh, he's done a dead terrible job, let the dust settle for 6 months, then you get a nice position on a board elsewhere for a nice salary. You know, that's what you do, isn't it? It's not a hard gig, is it, really?
Yeah, no, absolutely. And, as always with these things, the reality is that people get overpromoted and everything else. But I reckon there is one key skill the Centrica CEO does have and does need, and that is political savviness. Because ultimately, and as we've seen today with the announcement about the price cap and stuff like that, the reality is that it is terribly political, this whole utility supply business, because everybody hates paying their electricity bill or their gas bill or whatever. But the reality is, we need a service and we need to be serviced, and it costs money, particularly when you've got things like the government's green energy policy, you've got underlying energy and commodity price shifts and the like. And it's kind of interesting, actually, looking at, because you've had Ofgem come out. Ofgem, obviously, are the big the regulator. They've come out and talked about the new price cap, and it's coming out at a cool just under 1,200 quid a year for the most vulnerable of sort of households out there, which seems to me quite a lot of money. I mean, thick end of 100 quid a month on your gas and electricity is, I'm sure many people pay a lot more than that. But, for somebody who's struggling, that's a pretty big outlay. To be honest, I think this price cap is, as most price caps are, not worth the paper it's written on, in the sense that they've realised there are just some things that you just can't. If you start going down the price cap route, it just ends in complete madness. And I was not surprised to see Centrica shares up 3-4% when I last looked, mainly because the big fear about price caps is always overstated, in the sense that, when it comes down to it, Centrica aren't making big money on this. They're making a 2% margin on this business. So they're not not ripping customers off despite what's talked about. It reflects the fact that it costs money in order to get electricity and gas to your house. And, you know, there are better ways to sort of improve competition, improve service, give other options to low-income consumers than price caps. Far better to have a targeted subsidy or something like that than price caps. And I think the lunacy of price caps is shown today. You know, 1,200 quid price caps, bonkers.
So we've had that. What's happened today is, like, you know, you're right, you know, the expectation is almost what drives the price. And then the reality, like in this way, is good for Centrica. And the argument is, isn't it, with the price caps, that if you make it too harsh, too stringent, then it'll become, you know, the companies will just go, they won't bother in that space anymore. They'll move elsewhere and there'll be less competition in that area. So, it's, you know, you're not making competition better there, you make it worse. So, wow, look in the chart there, going back, let me scroll back, as far as 2013, midway through, it peaked at like 4 quid and it's been grinding lower ever since. And it's, I mean, due to all these political statements going out and, you know, getting hard with the energy companies, and it's now down to 1.48. But I just think we could be seeing a trend here, a bottom call. What's is it? They've got a decent dividend.
They have got a decent dividend. Look, it's 12p a share. So, you know, you don't need to be a math genius to work out that's pretty attractive, a bit more attractive than money in the bank. And they're committed to that and holding that for the next year or two. And over time, that their hope would be to actually make it progressive, to push it up a bit further. So it's yielding, you know, mid single digits. This is a terribly political stock. Your biggest political fear short term has probably been removed. The medium term risk would still be that Jezza, you know, leader of the Labour Party, is talking about nationalisation. Yeah, believe me that. I don't think that's going to happen. You know, irrespective of what you think about Jeremy Corbyn and Labour and whatever else, they're going to have bigger priorities than trying to nationalise Centrica. And in any case, they're going to have to pay the market price in order to do that. So my feeling would be this is a recovery stock, and I would still be holding on here.
Yeah, CNA, have a look at the chart there. It looks quite promising. We may have seen there's been a test of a really low 125 pence, and it really oversold. They bounced back, and it's been grinding around that 140 level. But today, that gap up may see the start of a grinding higher. But here we'll wait and see. But I think there's a half decent. It's worth looking at that stock. Marvellous. Anything else, Chris?
Well, got to have a think about Dixon's Carphone. Obviously, we all know Dixon's Carphone. You know, premier number one player in consumer electronics. Come up with a little update today. Reiterated their full year expectations for profits, 300 million quid, sounds all right, particularly given some of their peers can't make money in this area, that's not too bad. They are talking about flat like-for-like sales, that's in line with expectations. That shows you how tough this whole area is, particularly as their online sales are still going up, I think it's about 13%, so in-store sales are clearly struggling. We all know this is well-known stuff. What struck me is that the shares have been a bit out of favour this summer. I don't really know why. I think ever since the World Cup started, people kind of thought, well, you know, people have bought their new big TV and it's going to be a tough old summer going on from here. But, you know, that doesn't seem to be the case. And my feeling would be, look, you're getting a 4% dividend yield, which is well covered. They've got low debt. They're chucking out profits of an okay nature. They're on a mid-single digit multiple. I would say, again, there's recovery potential here. I'm looking at the chart and I'm seeing resistance at 200 pence. And, you know, the share's 160 and change at the moment. That seems to me quite interesting. Bit of dividend yield, bit of share price recovery potential. We know the high street and the consumer's under pressure. But, you know, as always, the number one players, and they missed it again today, they're taking market share. And you put all of that together, no shocker, I'd buy Dixon's Carphone shares here for a rerun back at 2 quid.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. No, I'd look in the chart again and just... Again, looks quite interesting. Like I said, it's you know, it's come down low enough. All the moving averages are caught up now. They bounced above that 200 moving average. They've come back, which I like to see. They're a fair way below that at the moment. With it at 169, they're moving at 200, 188. So if it doesn't go below that previous low, which is 150 or 148 there, then it looks quite good. But it may test that again. But it may see another stock that looks like to be bottoming out on the chart. Cool. Anything else, Chris?
Well, final one has to be McCarthy and Stone, which is well known in the property space, particularly for retirement type properties. They've had a variety of shockers over recent months and years. Ever since they came back to the market, that you may recall, those with long memories will recall, they used to be on the market, they got taken private, they've come back to the market, the shares have not exactly sparkled on their second time around. And, you know, what they've been talking about is more difficulties in the property market, but some other specific issues which have impacted them and their expensive retirement home options for various people. And today's numbers, look, at least they don't, like last time, they didn't cut numbers again. They're sort of retaining their reduced profit expectations. But what struck me about the statement, and the reason why I'm not excited about this sector in particular and this stock specifically, is that there seems to be a perennial obsession in the sector with still wanting to get government help and assistance. And they look at the McCarthy and Stone statement today, it's talking about the need for government to give more support to the property market. And, you know, to me, Help to Buy and all the other initiatives, that they were started with good intentions. It was a more difficult time. People, first-time buyers wanted to get on. But when you're talking about big interventions to help the retirement market, to help the ongoing second home market and various else, it just tells you that we've gone way too far with all of this. And the reality is, I don't think the government's going to step in aggressively. I think some of the issues around the house builders at the moment, the reason why they've got horrible looking charts over recent months, is because people realise it's not just going to be a gravy train of subsidies and whatever else forever. It can't continue forever. And even despite all of that, the property market is still troubled because of, you know, frankly, high property prices versus underlying incomes. But McCarthy and Stone's statement today, I'm not inspired by it. I wouldn't be chasing it here. The shares have recovered mildly since their big profit plunge of June. But frankly, it still looks down and out to me. They've got a big update, a capital markets day in late September, where the interim CEO, you know, again, there've been some management changes there recently, will be giving some views. Yeah, not one to chase, I would say, or to bottom fish on. My general views of property sector shares remain cautious. And despite what appears to be sometimes good dividend income or, you know, share price charts that are out of favour and maybe offer potential, not one for me at the moment.
Yeah, I mean, it's true. When they're asking for government intervention to prop up the business, that shows it's not a viable business. You can't rely on that. I mean, like I said, and to get anything done at that level, you know, with the government takes a long time anyway, if it ever does get done. So, yeah, exactly. I just think that you've got to stand on your own 2 feet, whether you're retired or not. You know.
But the thing is, I mean, go back to Centrica, where we started this conversation. You know, what Centrica was saying is, don't put a price cap on, you know, don't intervene in the market. The market is working okay. You know, there's competition. And if you intervene, you're just going to mean that we're not going to invest because we're not going to have any confidence. And I can live with that, because that's the company saying, let us get on with it. You know, that's the whole point of privatization in the first place back in the 80s. But this is the other side of it. And it doesn't sit well, particularly as you go back to the last statement, they were bleating about Brexit. You know, irrespective of what you think about Brexit, you just got to get on with it. You know, a company is not going to be able to influence Brexit ins and outs particularly. You just got to get on with it and be practical about it. You can, if you keep on finding too many excuses, then yeah, I'm afraid it's not a share to be chasing.
No, exactly. I hate that when people just blame things you can't change. That's not going to help you at all. What can you change? Work on that bit, you know, rather than what you can't change. It's pointless. A waste of time. Marvellous, Chris. Thank you for that. And we'll speak next week, fella.
Sounds a good plan. See you then.
Okay, it's time for the top five most followed companies on Vox Markets in the last 24 hours. They are at five. Nkundizi Energy, NCCL. At four, Anglo-African Oil and Gas, AAOG. At three, Sirius Minerals, SXX. At two, Brave Bison Group, BBSN. Big rise of the day. We covered them on the chart with Nicola on Facebook. You can check out our page there, voxmarkets.co.uk/... But no. I got that wrong, didn't I? It's facebook.com/voxmarkets. Check out the video there. Number one, most followed company. Also, well, it's going the other way, actually. It's been sold off massively in the last few days. But Foot Asylum, ticker there is Foot, most followed company. Okay, top five most liked RNSs are as follows. At five, Zenanga Iron Ore, result of AGM. At four, Vast Resources, update on Blueberry Project. At 3, Sound Energy, Eastern Morocco, award of production concession. At 2, Valrix, update on clinical development. And number 1, most liked RNS, is also on the podcast today. It's Rehabil Resources placing to raise 4.8 million. That's it for the podcast. Thanks for listening. Muchos apreciados.
The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite. Nothing in this podcast is intended as investment advice, and the people in this podcast may hold positions in the stocks they talk about. Do not buy anything based solely on a tip or recommendation. Please do your own research.